Thank you for the invitation. It's a great pleasure, as always, to be back in Santa Barbara. And today I'll be talking about something which is somewhat speculative and preliminary. So nothing has been published yet, even though I've given various talks on this topic over the last year in various places. I could also talk about tachyon condensation, but since Cindy was here last week, I'm happy to answer questions, but she did all the hard work of actually giving you the technical side of the story. Today's talk is going to be more speculative than that, so hopefully we'll all have fun just speculating about some questions relevant, hopefully, to quantum gravity or not. So let me explain the notion of a Lipschitz point. This is something that's coming from condensed matter theory and was discovered first by Lipschitz in the theoretical setting in the 40s, where he was interested in tricritical points, which were at the boundary between some spatially modulated phases and anti-ferromagnet phases in condensed matter systems. And he discovered something very interesting, a system which has a non-trivial dynamical critical exponent, and later on I'll explain what that means technically. My question is whether that part of condensed matter theory might be relevant and useful for high energy physics, in particular for quantum gravity, in particular also for making new possible UV completions of systems such as Yang-Mills theory in various dimensions, or ultimately again quantum gravity is at the forefront. Yes, that's the Lipschitz. Okay, so I'll start by posing a string theory motivated auxiliary question, and I ask you not to question the sensibility of that or the auxiliary problem too much, because it's not going to be really something that we want to solve for whatever reason. We'll use it only to motivate somehow what comes later. So my auxiliary question is going to be the following. Recall that in topological string theory, the partition function of the theory is somehow strangely related to the wave function of some higher dimensional system. And again, I'm not going to be very precise about this recollection of some basic facts, because I'm not going to be addressing this. Of course, this famously led to the OSV conjecture and other interesting things relating black hole entropy, topological string partition functions, and so on. What I'm interested in is asking whether this type of relationship, where on one hand we have the partition function of a system such as realistic string theory, perhaps critical strings in 26 bosonic dimensions, perhaps the superstring, and on the other hand we have the ground state wave function, so let me put a zero down here to indicate that what I'm interested in is the relationship between the partition function of a system on one hand, such as critical string theory, and the ground state wave function of some system in one higher dimension. So this is something which I would like to understand more conceptually, in particular for fundamental strings. So let's start with bosonic strings. And let's try to ask the auxiliary problem in the following setting. Let's define the partition function of the bosonic string formally by summing over all genera with the string coupling weight. So this is supposed to be the conventional expansion in the powers of the string coupling. H is the genus of the surface, let's consider closed bosonic strings. And F sub H is, of course, the genus H partition function. And that is defined as usual in the conventional path integral way. So just to summarize and introduce some of my notation, this is of course the conventional story. I'm in the critical case, so for simplicity let's consider 26 flat dimensions. Maybe you want to compactify some of them on the torus. I don't really think that's so crucial. And HAB is my worksheet metric, and I'm assuming that this is a critical string, so the gauge group is really diffeomorphisms as well as the Weyl invariants of the worksheet theory. So I consider this a quantum gravity system on the worksheet. This is then the path integral at genus H, Riemann surface, very conventional pedestrian kind of string theory thing. This is the usual action. Let me put a 2 down here to indicate this is a two-dimensional Euclidean action whose basic fields are x mu's and the Wolfson metric. So everybody is extremely familiar with this, and my statement is I define formally the sort of second quantized partition function of the string by exponentiating.
Formally, you really.
Yes, this is a very formal.
By formally, you mean as an asymptotic expansion.
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm ignoring systematically all non-perturbative corrections. And this is sort of following the footsteps of what people have done in the case of topological strings on some collabial threefold. And then they were asking how that is related to black hole entropy. So the idea is to ask the following still auxiliary question. Is there a system, perhaps a membrane theory, such that it has a second quantized ground state wave function? And let me introduce a slightly exotic notation. This double line will distinguish this state in the second quantized theory from another state which will be in some first quantized theory on a fixed word volume membrane later. So is there a state psi zero such that I can think of this partition function of the bosonic string as the square of the ground state wave function? Now, I should explain what this means. I'm obviously assuming that my ground state psi zero is not normalized. If it were normalized, this setting would be obviously not working. So what do I mean by the quality? For the superstring, it wouldn't work also for, because of supersymmetry. So let's consider bosonic strings.
It would work.
It wouldn't work, no.
Why? Zero would be one.
Sure. But you could ask, are there more sophisticated questions in the case of the superstring? And I'm not interested in them because this would lead me completely in the orthogonal direction compared to my main interest. So I have already defined for you the left-hand side, again, purely perturbatively, ignoring quantum non-perturbative corrections in the string coupling. What do I mean by the right-hand side, and what do I mean by an equality? What I mean is that I'm looking for a ground state, which in the Schrödinger representation, let me rephrase this in a slightly different language. Let's imagine that we have constructed a state of a first quantized theory of membranes. So in order to tell you even what the definition is of this object here, what I mean by it explicitly, let's consider first the analogous question in the first quantized setting. So let's hypothetically imagine that we have a theory of membranes such that the wave function, so this is a membrane which has some fixed spatial topology. It's a closed surface of genus H, and it evolves. There is some worksheet evolution described, hopefully, by some word volume action. Later on, I'll tell you exactly what that word volume action has to look like. But for now, let's imagine that somebody gives us this theory, and it has a ground state described by this psi zero with just one line on the right. So this is a first quantized ground state in the Hilbert space of membranes of spatial topology sigma sub h, such that when I calculate the overlap of this ground state wave function with itself, it reproduces precisely this mathematical expression. Now this allows me to define more precisely what I mean by this overlap. Again, psi zero is also not normalized. So you might be worried that the right-hand side is just a number. The left-hand side is also just a number. I'm just comparing a number to a number. How difficult is it? What I'm going to require is that these two things agree not just as numbers, but already as densities on the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. In other words, I'm asking, is there a theory of first quantized membranes such that when you quantize this in some Schrödinger representation, the ground state wave function would be a function on the moduli space of Riemann surfaces and on the space of configurations x mu, such that when I evaluate the integral over the moduli space of the square of the ground state wave function, I reproduce precisely this expression. Now, the answer to this auxiliary question, at least for the bosonic string, is surprisingly yes. One can write down a formal theory of membranes that give me this particular type of Schrödinger ground state wave function, which does reproduce F sub H through this expression. And I'll show you in a few minutes exactly how that works. For now, I'll assume that that state has been already constructed. Again, I will show you how it's constructed, but for now, let's just assume that we are given these states for all genera sub H. So H is anything from 0 to infinity. And let's see if, given the solution to this problem, the first quantized problem, can we go back to this question at the second quantized level and solve that problem.
Sure. You're assuming that the space-time itself is just flat,
yeah,
with no other
things
turned on. You're not going to ask that they agree if you start turning on the background flows.
You could ask what happens in generic sigma models, and to some extent that has been looked at, but I would like to leave that outside of the talk. I'm happy to talk about it afterwards, but it will take me too far off the main point, which is really in 3 plus 1 dimensions, essentially. Forget strings, eventually we'll try to apply the lessons, which we haven't learned yet, even to the case of 3 plus 1 dimensional gravity with no strings. So let me get to that.
F of H is still a function of the moduli?
Well, F of H here is the full number integrated. So I'm saying this is already true at the level of the densities. So the left-hand side is a density on the moduli space and a functional of X. And the right-hand side is an integral of, again, a density and a function of X. And they already agree point by point in the functional space, not just as integrals. I'll show you exactly how this works once I'm done with the next step, which is to assume that I'm looking at a solution of the first quantized problem. Then can we solve the second quantized problem? So the construction there is very elementary. It's basically just a simple many-body technique, essentially just combinatorics in some second quantized Fock space. So given some simple notation, let's consider the following. Let's take the spectrum at a fixed genus of this membrane theory. So it contains this particular selected preferred state, which will play the role of reproducing F sub H. And perhaps there is a bunch of other states, which I'll collectively denote by psi sub A or alpha in order to introduce a different index. So this is an index that goes over some undetermined, uninteresting set of basis states in the full spectrum of this membrane theory. And I don't particularly care what these other states look like. I'm just interested in constructing the second quantized ground state. So I'll take this first quantized problem and associate creation annihilation operators, as you would normally do in many-body physics. A sub 0 H is associated with the ground state, and then A sub alpha H will be a creation annihilation pair associated with the remaining states. And of course, then you construct a second quantized Fock ground state of membranes of genus H in the obvious way. It's defined to be the ground state annihilated by all these annihilation operators. Now, the full Hilbert space of the second quantized theory will be just the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces. Oops, sorry. The Hilbert spaces of genus H. And in particular, there is one big vacuum, which is the tensor product of the individual vacua of membranes of genus H. So what I've done here is just I've defined a big second quantized Hilbert space of three membranes Given the spectrum of free membranes of genus H, this big Hilbert space now contains
symmetrization
within each. There is a. These are just boson equation and annihilation operators. So.
Hilbert space is really the symmetric part of it. Anyway.
Sure. If I put a hat on top, is that? I believe that is the conventional notation. Okay, so this is a very formal, simple, elementary definition of some free.
Technically, that's related to the fact that you can connect these guys by infinitely thin to them.
Possibly, although interactions are, of course, outside of the scope of what I can discuss. So the statement now is that if you prepare the following state in this second quantized Hilbert space of membranes, it's created by the following exponential from the Fock space vacuum. So the prescription is form this particular state, and that I claim is the solution of the second quantized problem. It's again a very elementary combinatorics. There is nothing fancy in this statement, other than, and this is the only reason why I'm mentioning the solution of the second quantized problem. This state is not just some random, uninteresting state in the second quantized Hilbert space. This is a Bose-Einstein condensate. Of the membranes of genus H. And this condensate is correlated across various values of H by the fact that the corresponding coefficient of the condensate, the strength of the condensate, is always related to the string coupling. It's always just a particular power of the same quantity G string. So I don't know what this means. This is an interesting observation, though, that if there were a theory of membranes which would be doing this for you at the level of the first quantized Hilbert space, reproducing genus by genus the partition function of the bosonic string, then the second quantized problem, the problem which is analogous to the OSV conjecture, would be solved for you by a formation of this cross-correlated Bose-Einstein condensate. So, fine. That's a separate piece of information. I want to go back to solving this first quantized problem now, because we haven't convinced ourselves that this first quantized state psi 0 can be constructed at any genus H. Any questions about this? I have many questions about this statement, but I don't know how to answer them, so if you have questions, I will just add them to the list.
The operator X, your chi fields,
I haven't introduced any second quantized membrane fields or anything. So if I did, then there would probably be some interpretation of this state in terms of that second quantized membrane field.
Your moduli fields.
Moduli fields?
Yeah. The things you didn't integrate over when you did the first quantized.
No, I actually did integrate. If you calculate the overlap, then this is already integrated. Both sides are integrated.
I thought you said it was true at the level of the densities.
It is already true at the level of the densities. The formula here has been written already as a formula for the total integral, but it would be also true. There is a refinement of that formula which is true.
Versus quantized, whether you integrate out those fields.
No. This is the world volume theory that gives you the path integral, and that world volume theory gives you the first quantized answer, and then you can formulate some second quantized theory of multiple membrane states. And this formula up here lives in that second quantized Hilbert space. So that would be obtained by associating some creation annihilation operators with the decomposition of some hypothetical membrane field into oscillators, and I don't want to get into that too much. So I'm just saying that at the level of reinterpreting this formula back at the first quantized level, this state here, unlike the original vacuum in the Fock space, does not have a fixed number of membranes even, and it behaves exactly like a Bose-Einstein condensate. And I find it curious, although I don't know what that means, and I want to leave it at that, because what is really interesting to me is how in the world did we possibly solve this first quantized problem? What happened on the world volume versus world sheet that allowed this relation to happen? And that's the interesting part of the story. So let me move on to that. And that brings me to the notion of what I would call membranes at quantum criticality. And you start seeing the connections to condensed matter theory, in particular to quantum critical phenomena and the Lipschitz point as a generalized tricritical point. You'll see this very quickly. So the next step is membranes at quantum criticality. So I'm planning to solve the first quantized problem now. So is there a theory that I can develop at some path integral level on the world volume that reproduces this first quantized formula on some fixed genus H? So again, the setting is that I'm looking at some compact world volume evolving in time. So this forms a three-dimensional world volume of some membrane. And I want to be able to write the integral of dx dh over the volume of the gauge group e to the minus s as essentially, and I'm going to put this in quotes because I will decode what that means for you momentarily. Conceptually, morally, we are interested in this type of relation where you're supposed to allow this to be true already at the level of densities, but I'm writing it for simplicity already in the integrated version. So this seems like a difficult problem. We'll have to deal with the gauge invariance on the left-hand side. Somehow we want to match that on to the same type of gauge invariance for the calculation of the overlap of the ground state wave function on the membrane side. And so let's try to solve this problem first for the simpler case of only the world sheet matter. So for that purpose, it doesn't matter to me whether I have 26 scalars or just one. And let's therefore try to answer the following first. Let's consider.
Sorry, left-hand side is the string theory.
Yeah, the genus F sub H, the partition function on genus H.
The right-hand side is just the norm of psi.
Exactly.
Why don't you just take psi naught to be, define the measure to be the same measure of psi
naught
to be?
Yes, exactly. That's the point. And the question is, what is the Hamiltonian that gives you that particular ground state wave function? It could be supersymmetric. It is very closely related to stochastic quantization, which obviously can be rewritten in some Parisi-Sulov supersymmetric form. I'm not going to be dealing with supersymmetry at all, although we will see in two or three lines formulas which are very reminiscent of the BPS formulas. So let's try to answer the following question first. Let's consider just a single scalar field in two dimensions. Of course, the action is just this relativistic action, and I'm for simplicity sitting on a flat two-dimensional Euclidean space-time, or world sheet if you want to call it world sheet. And let's see if there is a theory with a ground state wave function, which is a functional of x, that satisfies this precise relation. Now, this is a question that has been answered in recent years by condensed matter theorists. There is a particularly beautiful paper by Fendley, Fratkin, and I'm afraid I forgot the name of the third author. They actually realized that the answer is given by a specific system at quantum criticality, a quantum critical system. So the answer to the question of what is the dynamics of this hypothetical 2+1 dimensional theory that reproduces this ground state wave function. You have to postulate a 2+1 dimensional action, which is known also as the Lipschitz scalar action. It's an example, the simplest free field kind of Gaussian example of a system at quantum criticality with a new interesting critical exponent which takes an unusual value. But the idea is to write down this type of action. You postulate, in addition to your two Euclidean dimensions, you have an extra time dimension. So this, to me, will be the dimension along the word volume of the membrane in the transverse direction to the string worksheet. This guy here is just the worksheet or spatial Laplace operator in those two dimensions. And if you write down this type of strange anisotropic action, then it turns out, for the following simple reason, this will be the theory whose ground state wave function will reproduce the partition function of the relativistic scalar field through that formula.
It's sort of obvious.
It is obvious, yes.
Sort of like a harmonic oscillator.
It is very obvious. Yeah. It's still called the Lipschitz scalar theory, and some branches of condensed matter theory are making a big fuss of these types of systems, but it is...
So this was Lipschitz? Came from Lipschitz?
This came from Lipschitz in the 1940s, because what he was doing, he was looking at the Euclidean signature version of this and saying, maybe I have a 2 plus 1 dimensional system which is anisotropic because I tune not just some terms in the potential, but also I tune the spatial part of the kinetic term. So there's some coefficient mu that you can tune to zero to get to some tricritical point. And that's a tricritical point between the regime where if mu were positive, you would be looking at some homogeneous, perhaps anti-ferromagnet or ferromagnet or something. But when mu turns negative, you have a spatially modulated phase. So the tricritical point between those two phases would require you to tune this guy to zero, in which case you need to include the subleading part in the expansion derivatives. And the Gaussian fixed point is now dominated by this anisotropic behavior. So it's a beautiful, of course, elementary example of a system which is at quantum criticality in the following sense. If I think of t as the actual physical time, so back to, it's difficult to use some reasonable terminology here because this is, of course, not Minkowski signature because this is no longer Minkowski invariant. This is not Lorentz signature, and the other one wasn't Euclidean, but, you know, it's real time or imaginary time. I don't know what the correct terminology should be. Anyway, so I'm back at...
Sorry, why can't you use...
What's the energy?
Sorry?
Why is this not Lorentzian signature? Well, it's not Minkowski, but...
Well, because time and space enter on a different footing in the action. The action is of high order in space derivatives and of... So this is not Lorentzian invariant.
Not Lorentzian invariant, but...
This is not
but time is still
sitting on some Minkowski space because there is no Minkowski metric with respect to which this would be the kinetic term. So you can call it Minkowski, you can call it anything you want, as far as I'm concerned.
It's the sign of the time, real time.
There is still a signature.
Yeah, there's a signature that's
minus. There's a signature, and that's why I'm saying, I don't know what is the proper way of referring to
real time
versus imaginary time is probably the best way of referring to the signature choice. So when I'm looking at this as real time, it is... conventional in condensed matter theory to introduce a critical exponent, which is known as... No, this is not even Galilean invariant, if that's what you were asking.
There's no invariance under transformations to a moving frame.
There would be if you were willing to introduce another sort of a Spurian background field, which represents the velocity with respect to some absolute frame. So that symmetry would act on that velocity. So. Anyway, maybe I introduced the notation for quantum critical exponents and so on in a minute. Let me just finish the argument, as trivial as it might be, that this actually does reproduce produce a solution to the original goal. The argument is trivial. Go to the Hamiltonian. In this theory, the Hamiltonian will have momentum squared, which is defined in the usual canonical way, plus 1/4 of Laplace x squared. I'm going through this in order to indicate how we would want to solve the more complicated problem with diffeomorphism invariance, because that's going to be done along the similar lines. But of course, diffeomorphism invariance will complicate things a little bit. So the momentum in some Schrodinger representation looks like this, and the Hamiltonian can then be factorized into the following suggestive form. You can write it as this object times the conjugate object . So let me call, can you see down here? Or maybe I should rewrite things. Let me call this object in the parentheses Q. This is Q dagger. So up to some normal ordering constant E0, the Hamiltonian almost looks like it wants to be supersymmetric, but I don't want to talk about supersymmetry here. So for me, Q is just an object, which whenever it annihilates, so if you have a wave function psi of x such that it is annihilated by q, it is going to be a ground state wave function. For the usual BPS type argument, the Hamiltonian is essentially qq dagger. So if q annihilates it, the lowest eigenvalue corresponds to this function. And what is the way of solving this? So again, q was.
This is quantum critical because there's a scaling where t goes like.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah.
This is a variant if you scale time like that sigma.
This is a quantum critical point where the so called dynamical critical exponent is equal to 2. It's essentially, for us, we can define the quantum critical, the dynamical critical exponent by, let's say, postulating that the spatial dimensions have dimension minus 1 in some natural units, as we would usually assume in high energy physics. And then the question is, how does time scale? The dimension of t is minus z. So just as David was saying, if time doesn't scale the same way as space, z is not equal to 1, and you are in one of these more exotic quantum critical systems compared to what high energy theorists are used to. They're not exotic from the point of view of condensed matter systems, but in condensed matter, all kinds of strange values of z have been seen, all kinds of fractional values, and z can be 3/2. In conventional Galilean invariant models, z would be equal to 2. In relativistic models, it would be equal to 1 by Lorentz symmetry, but here it is obviously by inspection equal to 2. So we have one of these unusual, from the point of view of high energy theory, quantum field theories. But it's a conventional.
I mean,
This is a as solvable and as under control as it can be. It's just a Gaussian integral. So anyway, so back to solving this problem of Q annihilating the ground state wave functional. This has an obvious solution, namely e to the minus 1/2 dx dx. Because what is this? This is just the equation of motion that you pick up from varying this action, and you compensate for it by having this explicit variation piece. So that's why these two things cancel each other, and you, in an elementary way, solve the Schrödinger equation by this ground state wave function. And again, I don't care about the normalization of that wave function as a matter of principle. So this was apparently a system which was written down in 1941 by Lifshitz, in case you wondered. And the interesting thing about the system, again, it's an obviously trivial system, but I want to make a few more comments. One of them being, what is it that distinguishes strings from any other brain of any other dimension? Or what is it that distinguishes string theory from particle physics? One thing that I always stress in string theory classes is that two dimensions are the critical dimension for the scalar field. X is dimensionless precisely in two dimensions, leading to the possibility that the quantum conformal invariance of sigma models predicts Einstein's equations. It's an extremely rich system with an infinite number of classically marginal couplings. Quantum mechanically, you get Einstein's equations from conformal invariance in 1 plus 1. 1 plus 1, of course, assuming that you're looking at the conventional relativistic sigma model, z equal to 1. So this is why string theory is special compared to other possible systems because it sits at the critical dimension of this two-dimensional scalar field, which describes how the string propagates in the target manifold. What happened here when we moved to the Lipschitz scalar Gaussian, which has this anisotropy between space and time on the worksheet or work volume, we moved the critical dimension of the system. In fact, it had to happen precisely because this system now in 2 plus 1 is very closely related, as we have seen, to the 1 plus 1 dimensional conventional scalar theory. So not surprisingly, the critical dimension is now 2 plus 1. And that can be seen in a very elementary way. The dimension of the measure here is minus 2, but the time scales is 2 spatial dimensions, so this gets minus 4. You have 2 time derivatives here, that's plus 4. And then that means that x is dimensionless precisely in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So an interesting open problem, which I'm trying to convince some students at Berkeley to work on. I've been trying to do that for more than a year, and nobody has really seriously started working on it. But I keep telling them, look, Dan Friedan was the person who calculated the beta function for this case at Berkeley as a graduate student. So it's your turn next, and nobody listens to me. Anyway, so there is clearly an, if you couple this to a generic Simo model geometry.
Other question is, if you make x dimension 1, what is the hypercritical dimension now?
So you want me to couple this to the tachyon, essentially?
Well, this Gauss is the Gaussian.
Right.
And the Gaussian scalar field, could be a critical theory. It's dimensions or could be.
If this is in D plus 1, then the dimension of x is D over 2 minus 1.
So,
we can talk about this.
Plus 1. Okay.
We can. So, I agree that this is a very interesting set of questions because this is a new type of systems, new type of sigma models that can be studied, and you can try to retrace Friedan's steps. The novelty here being that until you couple this to gravity on the world volume, this doesn't even have the relativistic invariance. Yeah, but you can start.
3 plus 1 is borderline.
Okay.
Finite, right?
I think so. This just inherits all the properties of the relativistic 1 plus 1 system. Modulo some intricacies. For example, if you really have several scalars and try to consider the sigma model for this, then there's nothing that forces you to have the metric here be the same as the metric here. So you have a possibility of two different metrics, some biometric theory of gravity. This wants to couple to something more exotic compared to string theory. Is there some section through the space of all couplings that is self-contained under a normalized?
The target space Lorentz invariance can't be preserved without and breaking Lorentz invariance in the world tree, in the world volume.
I haven't really talked about Lorentz invariance at all in time.
What?
I haven't talked about Lorentz invariance in space-time, so I'm not sure I want to preserve it. Right, in
time.
Yeah, but this could be some compact dimensions you can.
But just what you did now doesn't preserve this.
Sure, but it is possible to write a sigma model of this form without violating any obvious world volume symmetry.
World target space symmetry.
It doesn't violate any work volume symmetry on this 2 plus 1 dimensional.
Well, except Lorentz invariance.
Which wasn't there to begin with. Already in the flat case. That's what I'm saying. That nothing locks these two metrics to be related to each other. We can talk about it. I think it's potentially fascinating, and I have very little to say because nobody has calculated beta functions for these sigma models. So, in any case, so this is the way in which things would work for the matter sector, at least assuming that the space-time is flat, because I don't want to get into these RG issues here. The question is, can we extend this to the full theory on the worksheet versus world volume? In other words, can we couple this to gravity somehow? And this gravity will have to be some strange exotic form of gravity, obviously, because you need to match the fact that the matter system itself is at z equal to 2. So what we are looking for is some z equal to 2 gravity at a Lipschitz point on the world volume, so that we can consistently couple the matter sector. Okay, so to cut to the chase, let me introduce, well, I've already introduced the fields. The fields were H of sigma on the worksheet of the string. So I'm just now turning them into fields on the 2 plus 1 dimensional membrane work volume. And that's certainly the minimalistic requirement. I should have at least these components of the metric, the spatial components of the metric. You could argue that I should be adding also the time space components or time-time components of the metric. I will, but for now, this is the minimal set of fields. And let's work in d plus 1 dimensions. The d here is, again, the same capital D that I just erased from the case of the scalar field. So I'm looking at a d-dimensional theory. Let me switch the notation on you a little bit. Let's call this, or maybe not. I don't want to confuse people too much. So I have the spatial dimension sigma and the time dimension, which now scales as a minus 2 in terms of the mass units, momentum units along the spatial directions. And I would postulate the simplest possible action I can think of, which does what it needs to do to the first approximation, at least. We'll talk about corrections later. So I'm trying to mimic what happened for the case of the scalar field, but now I'm trying to do the same with gravity. And what happened for the scalar field was I had the time derivative of the scalar field squared. So I want two time derivatives of metrics in here. I need to invent some way of contracting them against each other. So this is going to be some form of the DeWitt metric. And let's be general. Write down the most general thing, which is compatible with the symmetries here. And it's going to be HAC, HBD minus some constant lambda, which is arbitrary, as HAB, HCD. So we've introduced one undetermined parameter. If this were a relativistic invariant 2 plus 1 dimensional theory, this lambda would have to be 1 by relativistic diffeomorphism invariants. Here, the theory will not be invariant under all diffeomorphisms. Instead, it's going to be invariant under diffeomorphisms that preserve a favorite preferred foliation of spacetime. So these are only foliation preserving diffeomorphisms that I'll end up being invariant under. And then the next piece in the action was what I would call the potential term, which was formally of this particular type. I have the variation of some lower dimensional d-dimensional Euclidean action. Just like previously, in the case of the scalar field, that action was just this. And the variation of it with respect to x was Laplace of x. I was squaring the equation of motion of some lower dimensional action. So let's do the same with the gravitational system. Again, I have some HBCD here. And this is the first guess.
Right.
As far as a gravitational
function of HAB.
Yeah, S is just a functional of, this was really, well, it is also a functional of whatever other fields are in the theory, like X. But as far as the gravitational contribution is concerned, S sub D, if these two is really just the full covariant Euclidean action on the string worksheet, as this, for example, plus perhaps you want to couple this to other background fields or something. So the prescription is take your favorite action in D dimensions for gravity. Let's consider gravity, pure gravity first at the classical level, because this is going to be interesting even before we talk about the connection to string theory.
You're sort of taking the gravitational action and going to some kind of critical point, right, where you...
Or you can, there are probably like five or six different points of view one can take, and it's really, for example, you can think of this as an attempt to stochastically quantize gravity in D dimensions. So you would write down essentially a very similar theory, and then you would end up asymptotically at late times, you would asymptote to an equilibrium system, which would be hypothetically producing a path integral of the D dimensional gravitational system. Or you can think of this in terms of the setting up the Langevin equation for some time-dependent process, which is...
But you also sort of, compared to the scalar case, you've thrown away degrees of freedom.
No.
You've thrown away components of the full of Minkowski H.
Well, I never had them to begin with because I was inspired by two dimensions. I insist on having precisely the fields of the two-dimensional string worksheet, at least, and those were x mu and the two-dimensional metric. I still have my two-dimensional metric, and I'm asking, is this theory right?
From the point of view of a group, that's one-dimensional gravity theory.
Okay, let's get to that point right now, and the idea is the following. This setting might be the first guess of what might reproduce the two-dimensional ground state wave function that we look for, but it's not quite the full story, and what we need to do is actually to introduce those remaining components of the 2 plus 1 metric. One reason why this wouldn't obviously work is if you look at what it's invariant under, it's invariant only under spatial diffeomorphisms, but not under all foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms. All foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms should also contain spatial diffeomorphisms which can change with time, as well as pure time reparametrizations. And those are not the gauge invariances here. Even worse than that, while invariance is nowhere near being a symmetry in this particular case when d is equal to 2. So I should finish one more thing here. If d is equal to 2, well, if d is not equal to 2, what would be your favorite d-dimensional pure gravity action? Well, you would obviously want to start with just the Einstein-Hilbert action. And in that case, you would be squaring the left-hand side of Einstein's equations using some DeWitt metric. If d is 2, then obviously you end up virtually with nothing, which is just as well because we know that two-dimensional gravity on the string worksheet was non-dynamical. So we better match it against the 2 plus 1 dimensional z equal to Lifshitz type of gravity, which is also equally non-dynamical and doesn't have any propagating degrees of freedom. So this term in two dimensions goes away for the same reason why this term on the string worksheet goes away, unless you have a non-trivial Dilaton field. So that's good. But the remaining part is still invariant under only the spatial fixed diffeomorphisms that are time independent. So in order to get all the way to Weil invariance, which we need in order to reproduce the matching to the critical string theory, we do need to introduce a field which I'll call A sub A, which is the sort of the off-diagonal component of the metric. This is what typically in the 3 plus 1 splittings of conventional gravity is called N sub A. I was inspired to look at these things after reading a paper by Son and Wingate, and they were using capital A, so I got stuck for a historical reason with that notation. I'm willing to show you how this would generalize in d plus 1 dimensions when you include these two extra fields. But I'll be mostly interested right now only in the two-dimensional case, so let's concentrate only on this kinetic part. And the kinetic part, when you introduce this extra field, will become the following. So we'll have one power of inverse n in front. Then we have the original HAB dot, but now extended by sort of covariant derivative with respect to the time-space components of the metric. And I still have this arbitrary DeWitt metric between this guy and its obvious copy with the indices C and D. The great news here is that this is actually, strangely enough, willing to be Weil invariant. If you assign particular Weil transformations to the metric, to the scalar field N and the vector field A, again, these are really, you should think of them, I should have written down a more explicit formula. If you want to assemble them into a, and this is true in any dimension, if you want to assemble them into a d plus one dimensional metric, you can think of the metric in the following way. Let's say there is a speed of light, and that speed of light is being sent to infinity, so we are taking a non-relativistic limit. As c goes to infinity, these are the normalizations of the fields that I'm keeping. And you could actually also consider keeping the subleading piece in the time component of the metric, which is suppressed by 1 over c squared. And that actually ends up being on the same row as the time component of this vector field. But I won't keep the subleading piece. I will only keep the leading piece.
When you say that this is bi-invariant, you mean invariant under arbitrary rescaling of this three-dimensional?
Let me be more precise. Let me be more precise what the gauge symmetries are. Gauge symmetries will be, if I write this down, and if I wasn't lazy enough to write down the explicit transformation rules for all these fields, you would find out that that the invariances are arbitrary reparametrizations of sigma, which are both space and time dependent, arbitrary time reparametrizations, which are not allowed to be dependent on space-time. And then there is a symmetry which acts by rescaling the metric by an arbitrary scale factor, which is space as well as time dependent. And it acts somehow on N, and it acts somehow on A, but not in a way which would just rescale overall this metric G. The powers are different. But the theory is, while invariant, but only if lambda is set equal to 1/2, which is great because it's no longer a free parameter, and you end up with no free parameters, and you reproduce essentially the rest of the argument that gives you the string partition function at genus G by calculating the path integral in this theory with these invariances. Given the shortage of time, all I have to say about quantum gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So this is, roughly speaking, why this might be a consistent world volume description of some kind of a membrane theory. But once you write down this type of thing and you change the critical dimension from 1 plus 1 to 2 plus 1 at the cost of introducing this dynamical critical exponent equal to 2, the immediate question is, couldn't we try to do something very similar in 3 plus 1 dimensions and forget membranes and strings, just try to write down some kind of a quantum gravity path integral?
So this is naively normalizable.
Yes. Yes. And it's normalizable in the same sense as the conventional relativistic 1 plus 1 dimensional path integral on the worksheet. For the same reasons, gravity in this dimension becomes, again,
but not only that, it's finite.
It trivially reduces itself to, you can rephrase things in terms of the string worksheet path integral, which we know makes sense. And so in some sense, you haven't really added that much. You've just rephrased.
And if you calculate around some background metric, what is?
I don't know.
You don't have dynamical gravity in 3 dimensions here.
Correct.
Well, this isn't the same gravity theory. He's got more degrees of freedom because he's broken the symmetry. Well, do you have dynamics here?
No, it's equally non-dynamical as the two-dimensional worksheet gravity. But now, 3 plus 1 dimensions. So let's forget wild invariance, which was a big reason why this theory is essentially equally uninteresting as a quantum gravity theory, as the two-dimensional worksheet quantum gravity theory.
And your statement is that not only is the calculations of the ground state reduced to doing calculations in the original two-dimensional string, but any calculation involving
I should be more careful because I haven't done all calculations. So I've mostly concentrated on the ground state. To be honest, I don't really know what happens when you try to, for example, calculate the higher spectrum, but I suspect that the spectrum might be actually quite reduced. So,
But do you think this is related to some kind of topological theory?
I don't really know.
It's not a physical state, so it has to be sort of.
Well, you mean the gravitational sector itself? Yeah. Well, I needed the wild invariance there, so. And then you need to add matter fields, and it's very very much going along the same.
You don't have matter.
Well, it's like trying to quantize the Liouville theory then on the worksheet. Presumably, there could be some Liouville extension of the story. What I've tried to do is to stay exactly conformal, so I have to add so many matter fields just like in the conventional string critical path integral. So this hopefully provides some motivation for what I think is the really interesting story, and I seem to have there's some permutation in my notes. Okay, so 3 plus 1, can we get a theory which is at least power counting renormalizable? A power counting renormalizable theory of quantum gravity, which seems like nonsense because people have tried for 50 years or more. And
why would you expect it? I mean, I thought that
again,
you just showed that 2 plus 1 is sort of the critical dimension now.
4 is equal to 2.
Yeah.
So what you have
to
do,
Z.
You have to go to Z equal 3.
I see.
And if you do that, then of course.
But then you're having higher derivatives.
Even higher, yes. Yeah. It becomes
cubic square, right?
Cubic square. And you can ask, is there an action which is even capable of producing equational motion of third order in derivatives? And the answer is surprisingly yes, precisely if you are in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So now the action in 3 plus 1, and this is specific to 3 plus 1. So the action that I will write down for you does not exist or extend analytically to other dimensions. For reasons to become obvious, I have words of praise.
Said you're going to use an epsilon.
It's possible, but well, let's see. Let's see what happens. So, let me call the metric G finally. I'm sick of little h because it's so unnatural. I don't know why I started using it to begin with. So I have z equal to 3, which means that the volume is of dimension minus 6. And as David said, in terms of spatial derivatives, we need 3 derivatives squared to appear in a form something like this. The kinetic term, luckily, stays the same. Well, it is somewhat unfortunate because I already erased it. So if I didn't, it would still be the same one, except the metric would be called G now. Let's call it GIJ, because that's probably more conventional. So I would have this extended derivative. This is, by the way, exactly what appears in the 3 plus 1 split. Those of you who are somewhat familiar with the 3 plus 1 split of conventional GR will recognize this particular expression as essentially the extrinsic curvature of the three-dimensional slice. If you decompose the Einstein-Hilbert term into 3 plus 1, you would pick up precisely these types of terms. And the only thing is that this lambda parameter, which went away as a free parameter in 2 plus 1 dimensions because of Weyl invariance, it is still there. And it's arbitrary. In other words, it's unfixed by my gauge invariances because I don't have full diffeomorphisms, only those foliation preserving diffeomorphisms. So there's another copy, GKL dot plus stuff, just like here. So this is the kinetic term. And now we need a spatial potential term. So is there a three-dimensional action that we can use to write the spatial part of the action as a square of the variation of the three-dimensional action? And now the statement is yes, there is a three-dimensional action. Well, first of all, there is a term that I want to write here. It's called the Cotton tensor. Let me define it for you first. It's a symmetric traceless transverse tensor. None of these properties are manifestly obvious from the definition, but they're all true. So why is this an interesting object? As I said, it's symmetric, traceless, and transverse, meaning that DC is 0. So these are mathematical features of that tensor. But physically, it has several beautiful properties. First of all, it does follow from a three-dimensional action as its variation. This could be surprising because you're used to the fact that equations of motion are typically of even order in derivatives. So how can you possibly get an odd order equation of motion? Well, if your action is three-dimensional, you have the possibility of starting with a Chern-Simons action in three dimensions. And now the statement is, if you start with an action which is the Chern-Simons action written down in terms of the Christoffel symbol for gravity, but don't treat the Christoffel symbol as an independent gauge field, instead treat gamma as a function of Gij by the usual formula. So this is a horrible expression in Gij and its derivatives. You vary this three-dimensional action with respect to Gij, you get the Cotton tensor. That's a true statement. That makes it interesting. I can stick it in here. And there are several other very interesting features of this Cotton tensor.
First of all,
I don't know. That's the short answer. I would be happy, for starters, to get some pure quantum gravity theory normalizable in 3 plus 1, and we can start adding matter later. You can't solve all the problems of humanity in one step. So that's my policy at this point.
Also, again, it wouldn't look anything like Einstein's gravity.
I'll get to that. That's a legitimate question in the context of the pure gravity that I'm presenting here. In other words, how realistic or unrealistic is this? That's my point number four, which I'm getting to in the remaining minus 2 minutes of this talk. And okay. So two more fancy properties of the Cotton tensor. First of all, it is closely related to the condition of conformal flatness. If you ask under what circumstances is some d-dimensional metric representing a conformally flat geometry, in dimensions higher than 3, the answer is when the Weyl tensor is 0, you get a conformal flat solution. Now, famously, the Weyl tensor is trivial in 3 dimensions, so something else has to take over as the condition of conformal flatness. It's the vanishing of the Cotton tensor that takes over. So there is a very beautiful geometric meaning to the Cotton tensor. And finally, the Cotton tensor played a crucial role. And some people might be already complaining that I'm calling it the Cotton tensor, because in some of the literature, it's called the Cotton-York tensor, because as York showed, I guess in the late 60s or early 70s, the Cotton tensor plays an important role in sorting out what are the self-consistent initial conditions that you get to pick on some three-dimensional slice in conventional GR. Obviously, because of the analog of the Gauss constraint, you can't just pick an arbitrary metric and its derivative. There's some geometric sense of what can be chosen arbitrarily. And I don't really know the subtleties of the answer, but the answer is very closely related to the choice of the Cotton tensor, somehow capturing the right initial conditions that you can specify freely on three-dimensional surfaces. So this is sufficient motivation, in my opinion, for choosing that Cotton tensor in here as just about the only object that has the required properties. So I would start with Cij squared. And now we should probably turn off this recording device, because now the next thing I'll tell you is that there's a strange. Yeah, this is power counting renormalizable, that's for sure. You can ask, well, let's not turn off the recording device. I was about to make a connection to loop quantum gravity, which I think should be off record. But anyway, so loop quantum gravity aside, you can ask, what are possible relevant deformations to the system? And that's a very, very sensible question. Brings me back to the question about the realistic interpretation of this. There are various subleading terms. I've only kept track of what can define for me some UV fixed point. Assuming that this theory renormalizes nicely, and I'll have comments on that in a minute, you can ask what kind of relevant deformations you can start adding. And let me just list a few. For example, you could add Rij squared. Let me be just schematic like this. So this would have some non-zero dimension coupling. Mass to some power, which you can easily determine from the power counting. But also, if you look at the most relevant deformation, there'll be precisely two. One of them is the three-dimensional Ricci scalar, and the other one is just a constant. So this is something like a cosmological constant. They are legitimate deformations of the theory, And the important thing is that there is nothing else funny that you can get at this dimension, which would compete with the three-dimensional Ricci scalar that you can build out of the ingredients here. And that clearly means, and let me ignore the cosmological constant problem, this theory, as a pure theory of gravity, wants to flow in the infrared under this deformation. So this is going to be the most important term in the infrared. This guy combines with this kinetic term. If lambda is 1, this would be precisely just Einstein-Hilbert in the infrared. Now, lambda has no reason a priori to be 1 or renormalized such that it flows to 1 in the infrared. And to be honest, I don't really know what it renormalizes like. The calculation hasn't been done yet. But this is a very robust feature of these theories at non-trivial values of the dynamical critical exponent. For example, if you go back again to the Lipschitz scalar, we started with a theory which was like, was going like x dot squared plus fourth derivative terms. And if you add, again, the only reasonable relevant deformation that you can, it wants to restore Lorentz invariance in some coordinates, in some rescaled time and space. This will look at in the infrared limit as a relativistic invariant system. But it's, of course, an accidental, in the technical sense of quantum field theory, an accidental infrared symmetry. So the only question here is, what is the behavior of lambda? If lambda wants to stay close to 1, then you might be very close in the infrared to the Einstein-Hilbert action, just because this kinetic term, together with this scalar curvature, is precisely just the 3 plus 1 decomposition of Einstein-Hilbert into the Hamiltonian form.
It shouldn't be too complicated to calculate beta lambda in one go.
Let's do it right now. No, I agree completely, and I could go on about these things for a while. The loop quantum gravity connection, let me make it very quickly because it's really a formal connection. You could ask, this came from some arguments about ground state wave functions. What if we try to postulate the ground state wave function again in this system? Well, you would end up essentially saying the ground state wave function wants to be something like e to the minus S3, where S3 is this Chern-Simons action. Bad idea for two reasons. One, this is horribly non-normalizable, doesn't represent a physical ground state wave function of anything. Second of all, this has been claimed to be the correct ground state wave function for loop quantum gravity by various people in that community for reasons which are somewhat unclear to me because it's such an unphysical proposal. But it is precisely this type of Chern-Simons exponential that they proposed as the so-called Kodama ground state wave function. So that's all I have to say about loop quantum gravity. One final comment, which is somewhat not observational, but related to some data in the literature. This is disconnected somewhat from the body of what I've talked about. There's a beautiful numerical work by the group in Copenhagen and Leiden, I think. Ambjorn, Lowell, and Yurkevich, and other people worked on it. They claim to have some Lorentz signature discretization of quantum gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions, and they seem to be getting a nice, smooth continuum limit. The strange thing about that continuum limit, I can go through the details, but I don't have the time to do it, so I leave the details for the private discussions afterwards if people are interested. Let me make only two statements here. One of them is that they define the effective spectral dimension of space-time that they numerically simulate, and then they claim...
They're doing Euclidean.
No, they say that they do Lorentz signature gravity, but what they really do is they put a preferred foliation. They call it a causal structure. A foliation very much like this foliation here, and they write down a lattice action which is compatible with the symmetries. They take the naive continuum limit. They actually, in my opinion, do that in the Euclidean signature. They really rotate back and forth. And then they get some set of simulations. The simulations indicate that at large distances, the spectral dimension, which is defined in a way I can explain privately afterwards, approaches 4.02 plus minus something, 0.1. So it's effectively a four-dimensional spacetime. This is a beautiful result because this is probably for the first time when we have something four-dimensional out of discretization of four-dimensional naive gravity. But that same spectral dimension for very short distances approaches a different value. It approaches 1.80.
So I wonder, what does that mean for very short distances when you have a
tunnel? I'm happy to talk about it afterwards, and I don't quite claim to know what they precisely mean. It's a somewhat technical thing which requires to know more about numerical simulations than I do. So we can try to decode what they mean afterwards. So this is approximately 2. I think their interpretation has been, yes, the spacetime is nice and four-dimensional and smooth at large distances, but at short distances it develops some kind of a foam structure. Maybe it's two-dimensional spheres connected into some web of bubbling things and stuff. Now, my interpretation is completely different. I would say... Sorry?
Wouldn't you have said 6?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I say 2, because it's measured in the units of the time dimension. If you look at
no,
you have to measure, because the spectral dimension is defined in a particular way. I'll convince you. I'm sure I convince you that this is the correct way of measuring dimensions here.
Spectral dimension is
measured by going to the Euclidean signature and looking at a dispersion of a diffusion process and measuring the effective dimension of spacetime that the diffusion process sees. And the diffusion process is governed, of course, by a Laplace operator on the right-hand side if your spacetime is homogeneous. So that contains the time dimension part. So it's dt squared plus bi squared for spatial dimensions. In our case, this is going to get replaced essentially by di to the sixth. When you calculate the spectral dimension, and you get 2 in the infrared, you get 2 in the ultraviolet and 2 in the infrared because of the Laplacian coming back, essentially. So I at least propose an alternative interpretation of results like this. Namely, your spacetime can still be smooth in the ultraviolet, but maybe it scales anisotropically between space and time. And that, to me, is very sensible in light of what they've been doing. They've been putting this causal structure in by hand. So they have the same symmetries as in this case. And doesn't the theory want to be just completed in the UV in any way which respects the symmetry? If so, this would be the logical way of completing it by having these higher derivative terms. And that would predict that they should see an effective reduction in the spectral dimension down to 2. So I don't really know whether they are discretizing this theory without knowing it, but it would be my favorite interpretation of the results. So I should stop here since I'm already...
But they could probably test this more precisely.
They only have some small amounts of data, as far as I can tell. They can barely measure the size of the universe. They don't really have any observables. But it is an impressive amount of work that they've put into it and seem to be getting sensible long-distance limits of gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions for the first time. So, okay, thank you.
In the sense that you only have the gauge symmetry is larger in the infrared, right? You don't have the full coordinate variance until you get to the infrared where lambda is 1.
If lambda is 1, yes. Yeah, it would be an accidental infrared symmetry. So if lambda is not 1 but close to 1, then it could be in one of these slightly alternative theories of gravity that people have talked about. And I wonder how close to 1 would you have to be compatible with observational data. But there's really room only for this one discrepancy in the infrared between GR and this system, at least at the level of pure gravity. Now, if you start coupling matter, it's a different story because you can start asking questions. Why should different matter sectors see the same speed of light? Is there some kind of a gravitational locking that the mediation by gravity somehow forces them to end up all relativistic with respect to the same Lorentz invariants? I have no answers to those questions because that's just too far beyond what I've been doing so far with the system.
What do these gravity theories look like for lambda not 1? These people have studied them, but I guess I'm not familiar with them.
No, I'm saying that people have studied alternative theories of gravity where they were randomly turning on various Lorentz non-invariant pieces in the action, mostly on the phenomenological side of issues. So some of it is posted on the pH, presumably, rather than ERQC.
Testing as tests.
And then the question is, yes, what are the bounds on all these extra pieces that you can just randomly start adding to the action? And there could be more conceptually defined theories where people, for example, say perhaps the volume part of the metric is not a dynamical field. So
lambda, but in this theory, lambda is a dimensionless parameter that will it flow is somewhere.
Yes.
Definitely. Go to one, which would be.
Well, there is that accidental inherent symmetry, so.
Like gauge symmetries don't usually come with
it. I know.
Yeah. Lambert-Witten even makes it hard in some cases.
As I said, I have no calculation for what lambda wants to do. It definitely wants to do something because it's just a dimensionless coupling. Classical level.
And there are no other terms that are allowed, you say, by the symmetries.
As far as I can see.
Sure. It's a bit surprising because you have a lot of well,
that's because
what?
Because when you rewrite.
Well, what about terms that involve only one time derivative?
What about terms involving just n and powers of n?
You still have this time reparametrization invariance, and that actually buys you surprisingly a lot. In some sense, people have looked at theories, but they looked at them from the opposite point of view. They said, maybe the theories are fundamentally relativistic, but what if there is some kind of a ghost condensate or something that breaks spontaneously Lorentz invariance? And then they start basically from the bottom up. They try to look at effective terms in the effective action that can show up. And they only typically take the spatial diffeomorphisms as the surviving symmetry. They haven't been particularly careful incorporating also the full foliation symmetry of the preferred foliation. And that reduces the number of possible terms further. Or you could constrain n to be only time dependent and then add the subleading term in the time-time component of the metric, which wants to behave as a gauge field together with these spatial components. And that has the U1 symmetry. So there's always some symmetry which comes up, which constrains further the number of available terms. But the biggest thing is that the kinetic piece here is already exactly the same thing. This becomes more manifest when we rewrite it in the Hamiltonian formalism. Up to this lambda, this is exactly the same thing that comes from Einstein-Hilbert already in the Fourier relativistic case. There's no arbitrariness there other than this one single parameter.
What about just a term like trace k? And then you say that k is effectively the kinetic term is effectively the extrinsic curvature squared. It's a k squared term. So your question about lambda, if lambda is 1, I understand that means that you're controlling the trace of k squared and the trace k squared
right.
counter terms you could add. Isn't there just a trace k counter term, which is lower dimension?
Well, there'll likely be a total derivative.
Is it a total derivative?
It might be, because there's a time derivative piece in it. There's a time derivative piece in it, and there's a spatial. So this is essentially k, right?
Yeah.
So this I'm guessing that the important piece that you would want to keep ends up being a total derivative, and there is nothing non-trivial new that you could add. I forget the details. This is something I haven't looked at in the last year, so I should probably go back and redo the analysis, see where various terms go away.
It's either two flows that you want to consider, you'd like to calculate, right?
Lambda, well, it's actually more complicated than that.
Lambda and the infrared. You want lambda to go to one infrared.
Right.
And in the UV, you'd like this to be reasonable.
I forgot to go back to that denormalization in the UV. You may have noticed that the setup here is of a very particular form, where I have this kinetic term, which is essentially the time derivative squared, plus the square of some low-dimensional equation of motion. This is not accidental. I want that particular form because it's very reminiscent of stochastic quantization and non-equilibrium quantum dynamics, where those particular forms of the action are better under normalization than some generic forms of the action. If I want to write down a zillion terms with six-order derivatives, I could. Right? The Cotton tensor squared is not the only term which has six derivatives in them. So there is there's a whole bunch of formally marginal couplings I can add. And if I'm supposed to calculate a beta function in that multi-dimensional space, I'm probably doomed, because at least I'm doomed. Maybe somebody else can do it. But you don't need to incorporate all of them, because this form of the action is known in simpler cases, not for gravity, because gravity has never been properly analyzed in the form of stochastic quantization methods. But in simpler systems, that form of the action is self-reproducible under normalization. You don't produce a generic, essentially. That's one way of seeing it, yeah. So
you're saying you don't generate the R cubed terms, which would also be six derivatives.
Yes, that's correct. If you start with the Cotton tensor squared, you don't generate R cubed terms, and
is
you
that
might still
generate. Is equals one, or is that arbitrary?
Well, again, the full calculation for the full gravity system has not been completed, so I can't really say. But
well, a lot of interesting calculations.
Yes, that's true. So, but the idea is, I should mention one thing, that the renormalization of this D plus one dimensional system is, in this particular case, in simpler systems, always inherited by the renormalization properties of that lower dimensional system whose action you started with. In this case, the renormalization of the three-dimensional Chern-Simons gravity, even if you add the Einstein-Hilbert term in three dimensions and add a cosmological constant, this is claimed by people like Deser and others for a very long time, even prior to Witten's topological Chern-Simons reinterpretation of gravity. This is claimed to be a fully renormalizable, in fact, finite, so-called massive gravity theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So this is not just renormalizable, this is finite. And if the RG properties of this theory are inherited from the RG properties of this, then one is in a good shape. Again, the calculation...
Then lambda wouldn't flow.
The calculation hasn't been completed with all generality. These are all hints, and so I don't really know what the answer is going to be, but hopefully we'll find out at some point. I would like lambda to just be 1.
Yeah, but
if I tune it to 1 and it wants to stay 1, I'm happy.
You don't have to, what's the symmetry that makes it 1?
No.
It's hard to believe that it will stay 1 unless...
I agree. But it wants to flow somewhere, so where would it flow? 0, infinity, or 1, or some other?
Okay, let's thank you.